Okay, let me just get the beat. So that's the point. The thing is, if it's going to be outside, how are you going to keep adjusting it if you're inside? Unless you're going to operate outside. That's what I'm visualizing. You have to go back outside to adjust it and go back inside again and go, you know, all that stuff. All right, but we can work it out. See you later. Dick, back to you, WHCDL.
You can easily remotely tune it, Andy, with a Selsun motor. By a pair of Selsun motors, you can stand in the shack, turn one knob, and the other Selsun motor out there is turning the capacitor for you. Even your 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long, is a much more broadband antenna. But still, if you want it to, at the edges of the band, it's going to hit a 6-to-1 standing wave ratio. Your transmitter's not happy with that. You're using an antenna tuner in the shack. You're going to readjust the antenna tuner every time the QSY to one end of the band versus the other. So many of our antennas require tuning, but it's a predictable amount of tuning. And you can remotely tune if you want to with Selsuns and stepper motors and all kinds of ways of doing it for an electronic smart guy. Anybody have any further comments on all the above? K2LIW?
That makes more sense. That's what I was driving at. Okay, 73. George was out there. KD2FIU, WHCDL.
You got it, George. Wait for the beeps, and you got it, George. KD2FIU, you got the floor. K2RIW.
Hey, Dick, thank you so much. You answered every question, and I implore all you guys who are still listening, please go on YouTube and search for Mr. Carlson, C-A-R-L-S-O-N, and watch him fix this Yaesu 1000. Back to that. Thanks, Dick.
Yeah, I'll give you guys warning. These YouTube videos are addictive. I don't know how many times in the last 6 months I went to a YouTube video that had a piece of information I wanted. That, in turn, gave me some hints of other things on YouTube I could be looking at. I thought I was going to spend 10 minutes getting the answer to my question on YouTube, and you start looking at the other things that sound so interesting, and pretty soon you realize that 4 hours has gone by, and you didn't even realize it. The darn things are so attractive. Okay, Wes wanted to tell us something. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Thank you very much, Dick. What I see is that although cigarettes are very much criticized, which is good, it looks like all of the states are going to much more powerful drugs and call them recreational marijuana or whatever it is. That smells much worse and is much worse to the health. So it looks like it is, for me, I might be wrong, it is a plan action to make a room for new, much more powerful addiction. This one is not criticized. What is recreational in marijuana or any other of drugs? Why do they do it? Did you ever smell somebody who was burning this stuff around you? I mean, popping, whatever you call it.
It sure is crazy. Various people have put all kinds of pharmaceuticals and other things into their body because they think there's a magic potion somewhere that's going to give them more pleasure, make them smarter, have more memory, faster working brain, whatever. Craziness. Just being a healthy human being, eating the right kind of food, getting the right amount of sleep, and don't mess up your body with all kinds of foreign substances that were not intended to be there. That's the best way. And find yourself a good hobby and a good pet. Having a good pet can make your life a hell of a lot nicer. Yes, you're supporting some other living item, and that pet will worship you. Rich said the magic words. The kitty cat that he now has, named Marshmallow, thinks he is God. That kitty cat worships the fact that the litter box gets cleaned and the food gets given to him by a person called N2EO that he lives with and he sleeps with. What a good symbiotic relationship. N2EO. Defend yourself. K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich. He didn't expect me to hand it to him at this time. Okay. Before we leave the question and answer period of the TechNet, anybody have any final comments before we go over to the science talk? Give me a call, letters and name right now, K2RIW. Okay, we pleased everybody for tonight. And you got a little bit more understanding of that black art called antennas. To be a good antenna engineer, you must make a Faustian bargain. You have to make a bargain with the devil. Because it's black magic, all the real working words of rules of thumb on antennas. Get by while I hit my rig. I don't know why it's making all those sounds. How an antenna really works. It resonates first, then it will radiate. Make it out of low loss materials and the yuckiest looking mechanical structure that's nowhere near large enough will give you full performance. Because your antenna is small, doesn't mean its effective capture area is small, as long as you force it into resonance. There are very few antennas inside of your cell phone that have to operate at a whole lot of different frequencies. Connected to every one of those antennas inside your cell phone is an impedance matching integrated circuit right at the antenna. There is an antenna tuner on every one of those antennas inside of your cell phone. That's how that works with all those internal yucky located antennas. We no longer have a whip antenna sticking out of our cell phones. We still get full performance out of it, other than the fact your hand wrapped around it isn't absorbing local material. Roy's going to now tell us a beautiful puzzle, and he's also got a mailbag question. AC2GS, Dr. Roy, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thank you, Dick, and hello to everyone. I have a couple little bits and pieces of comments from previous conversations I didn't want to interrupt. Rich, W2BZ, mentioned Mr. Carlson's lab. It's a very engaging set of YouTubes. Just the other day, I must have spent 3 hours of my life watching him fix and retune an old Hammerland receiver. So that's one thing. And another thing is, I talked to Rich W2BZ about the capacitors. He would like to drive 100 watts in his magnetic loop. Because of the very high Q, it's going to have a very high voltage at the ends, and you're going to need a gap that's wider than an air gap that will break down for that amount of kilovolts. So yeah, I can't see how you can get a plate closer than, say, 2 millimeters from each other if you really want to use 100 watts. Another point is Derek Mueller is the gentleman who produces Veritasium, and I've posted a link on my website to the Veritasium video that discusses radiation and such. And a few other little things. One other thing is I mentioned last week I was going to put up some three-dimensional images of the radiation pattern as you go from a half-wave dipole to a three-half-wave dipole to a five-half-wave dipole. So that's on the website as well. It's roy.ac2gs.com. Let me break for a sec. Okay, the question I got in the mailbag, a gentleman asks, in order to inhibit RF energy from flowing back to the outside of the coax and into the shack, what effect would simply slipping a length of steel pipe such as 1/2-inch electrical conduit over the coaxial cable near the antenna feed point have to mitigate this condition? He also adds, often on HF it is recommended to coil 6 to 8 turns of coax at the antenna feed point to accomplish this. So that's his question for tonight.
That piece of pipe that he describes has a name. It's called a bazooka balance. You make it 1/4 wavelength long. The bottom end of the pipe is connected to the shield of the coax cable. The pipe is 1/4 wavelength long, and your coax cable goes down the center of the pipe, and now any RF energy that wants to get onto the outside shield of your coax goes down the inside of that bazooka balun, and it sees an open circuit and doesn't go beyond that pipe. I have used that on the feed horn feeding assembly that I did on the feed horn that was on the 12-foot parabolic dish antenna, August 1972, QST magazine. That was the antenna that listened to the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts while they were on the moon, and we listened to that signal directly on 2,000 megacycles, unified S-band frequency from the command service module, and we were listening to some very private conversations of the astronauts talking back to Houston during the time they were not connected to the network. So I heard some juicy stuff, if you know what I mean. Let me drop it. So there's a whole lot of bounding structures that are possible. To cover the waterfront, you can find by various techniques the Rustroff article, R-U-T-H-R-O-F-F. Mr. Rustroff had an article in Microwave Theory and Techniques Journal way back in the 80s, 1982 or something like that. I'm not sure when it was. The name of the article is Some Balloning Devices. He's probably got about 16 of them in there. So Mr. Rustroff covered the waterfront. A half-wave coax balloon is another one that's popular. A J-pole structure is a kind of a balloon. The bazooka balloon is a nice one. There's all kinds of ways of doing it with a poor man's RF choke by a few turns of the transmission line near the antenna. And even though you've got some RF energy coupled to the outside of your shield of the coax cable, if you can choke it off by multiple turns acting as an inductor, you can develop a high impedance in that inductor. And how high is the impedance going to be? You can calculate that. Let me drop. Once you know the diameter of your turns and the number of turns, in the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, there is a formula. The diameter of the turns, the number of turns, you plug it into that formula, it'll tell you how many microhenry you've got, how many nanohenry you've got. And inductive reactance equals 2 pi L over, wait a minute, 2 pi FL. 2 pi times the frequency times the inductance in henries tells you the amount of inductive reactance. And how much inductive reactance do you want? If it's a 50-ohm cable, and you've created an inductor that has an inductive reactance of, let me pick a number, 1,000 ohms, that's a damn good RF choke between your antenna and the rest of the transmission line. And that makes the antenna a lot more pure. Let me drop. If you directly connect your antenna, shield to one half of the dipole and center conductor to the other half, no local balloon at all. It's a slightly ugly structure electronically, but it's not a showstopper. So what if some of the signal is being radiated by the outer shield of your coax cable? There are some places when that's a disadvantage. If that cable runs near another piece of electronics, it's going to be getting a whole lot of electromagnetic interference. Then it's bad. And now the length of your transmission line becomes part of the antenna. There's another resonator in there, another radiator with some other angle of radiation. Sometimes that's good. So you can directly connect the coax. It's not a showstopper. It'll work. But you use one of the bowing devices, one of the choking devices. It is more predictable, and it will work better. And there's a zillion ways of doing it. And Mr. Rustroff gives you about 16 of those ways if you can find that article. You can directly go to that article if you're a member of Microwave Theory and Techniques. But that article became so popular, there must be multiple websites somewhere that will give you a copy of Mr. Rustroff's article. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy. I'm getting hoarse.
Okay, very good, Dick. Joe's question particularly mentioned he wanted to know what would the effect be if he isolated the steel pipe and there was no electrical contact between the two. I suggested to him that the beauty of coaxial cables with their shielding is that if you don't electrically connect things, coaxial cables tend to not be affected by their environment.
I see where you're going with this. If you made the pipe a quarter wavelength long at your operating frequency, and you dug through the outer polyethylene coating on the outside of your coax and connected the bottom of the pipe to the coax, that's the conventional way of doing it. If you don't want to damage your coax cable, and you make the pipe, instead of a quarter wavelength long, a half wavelength long. And let this half wavelength pipe sit on the outside of your transmission line near the antenna. Now you've made another kind of bazooka balance that requires no damage to your transmission line. A half wave of an open circuit is the same thing as a quarter wave with a short circuit, if you know what I mean. You don't have to dig in and make contact. I've never seen somebody doing that, but as long as you're on a high enough frequency where the half wavelength of pipe is not on, you're not going to do this on 80 meters. 80 meters, a half wavelength of pipe is 132 feet long. Not practical. But on 10 meters, the half wavelength of pipe is 16 feet long. That's doable. I've never seen someone do that, but it's not breaking the laws of physics. The theory works, I'm pretty sure. AC2GS, K2LIW.
WD2GXM.
GXM, go ahead, Rich.
K2RIW, WB2GXM. Instead of using pipe, could you use a copper tape and wind it around the coaxial cable for a length of a half a wavelength?
I think the answer is yes. Copper tape, I think we'll do it. You got to worry a little bit about the fact, though, that the glue on the copper tape is non-conductive. Therefore, your copper tape wrapped around the transmission line is a helical wound coil. It doesn't look it. It's a helical wound coil. The good news of that is that electronically a half wavelength of that is going to be a hell of a lot shorter than a mechanical half wavelength. It's a helical resonator. The amount of capacitance between the individual windings through that a thousandth of an inch thickness of the glue going to require some experimentation. By way of your good dip meter, you can find out how many turns or what length of copper tape resonates at your operating frequency. The ideal to half wavelength of balance is that it will be resonant at your operating frequency. So by way of your good dip meter, you'll find it. But the GXM, for any other comments, K2RIW, you got a good suggestion.
Oh, thank you. If I come up with something better, I'll let you know. WB2GXM.
There's only an infinite number of ways of making an antenna. And for a crafty ham radio operator talking to his buddies, he's going to find quite a few of them. You want an antenna designer, you got to hire a ham radio operator. He's got the experience and the passion. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Okay, thank you, Dick. That seems to answer Joe's question. I hope it does, at least. And if not, I'm sure he'll email me and give me another question for another time. So thanks, Dick.
We're ready for your puzzle, Roy.
Okay, I just want to add a little bit of more from the past. Everyone was talking about cigarette smoking, which is a foul habit, cigars, cigarettes, pipes, what have you. Tobacco has nicotine. The plant itself uses it as a natural insecticide, in the same way that things that have caffeine use caffeine as a natural insecticide. And so we're taking insecticide when we're smoking. And the problem with cigarette smoking, the nicotine drug is chemically addictive, neurologically addictive. It's a stimulant, so even if it leaves your body is primed for it, and it needs it. So that's one of the things that it does to you. Also, it constricts the blood vessels, like a peripheral vascular system. So if you already have diabetes, you have a poor circulation to begin with, it constricts those vessels. And you end up with having to have legs and arms amputated, so that's not good. It also tightens up your coronary arteries and gives you a heart attack, so that's not good. And it also contains tars and such, which are carcinogenic, which cause the cell lining in the lungs to mutate and turn into cancerous things. And what they've done, it has to do with the alkalinity of the tobacco. Cigars are very alkaline, And so the nicotine is very strong, and that's why no one but a lunatic would breathe in cigar smoke. They just kind of let it waft. Cigarettes tend to be more acidic, so they tend to have less active nicotine, but they've been putting ammonia into it to alkalinize it to give people a better, stronger addiction. And one other little aspect about nicotine, every so often you'll hear stories of little children eating the filters at the butts of cigarettes, and they can very often kill themselves. They poison themselves with the amount of nicotine that's in those filters. So smoking bad, not smoking good. Let me drop. Okay, I just want to remind everyone that if you have any mailbag questions or if you have any topics or questions or answers or refutations or what have you, the email address, as always, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the webpage with the links, there are images of radiation angles for dipoles and all kinds of fun stuff, and there will be more when I finish this. Today is the web link is roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop, and I will give you a puzzle for the night.
Can I ask the question that what you just said?
Okay, Wesley, ask the question.
Don't you think that it is purpose in restricting cigarettes but allowing other drugs to be more popular and states agreeing because of money that they have from it to allow people to smoke it? One of them is marijuana. And what is the difference of marijuana in terms of impact of the health versus cigarettes? So don't you think it's just a greedy money and tricks you?
Well, Wes, this sounds like a perfect question for the political net that begins at 12:10 tonight. But going back to the question, I think legislatures and businessmen are greedy, and they just see it a new way of making profit. And, you know, capitalism is what they say makes America great. Marijuana is not terribly dangerous, at least all the studies would indicate. It's not really the gateway drug that people frightened each other about way back when. THC is far less addicting and has less side effects than nicotine. There's a lower tar content, the cancer risks, and the number of cigarettes people smoke of marijuana are much smaller than the amount that they do with nicotine. So although I don't smoke anything, I mean, fortunately, when I was 5 years old, my father thought it would be real cute to give me a lit cigar. And after I finished coughing, I gave up on the whole damn exercise. But nevertheless, if people want to do it and it doesn't hurt anyone else and it makes a lot of money for the government, who needs a lot of money because they're spending a lot of money and otherwise they're going to get the money from us in another way, I don't see a terrible problem. I guess it's more of a moral, ethical issue. And it's only, to my knowledge, marijuana. I do not think they're planning to make cocaine legal.
Thank you very much for that.
Doug, thank you, Wesley. Anyway, on to the puzzler. When the universe was young, according to the most popular of the Big Bang theories, things were a lot smaller and a lot hotter. Now, for every free quark or electron, there were billions of neutrinos and billions of photons. And those billions of photons were very, very energetic. Now, over time, the quarks coalesced with their gluons into being neutrons and protons. And the electron expanded more and more, and a little after about 380,000 years after it all began, the average temperature of the universe is believed to be about 3,000 degrees Kelvin. At that point, the black body radiation photons of the universe were not powerful enough to keep every atom ionized, and atoms captured enough electrons to become stable neutral atoms, and with fewer ions around, the universe actually became transparent, and all the photons became visible throughout the universe. At 3,000 degrees Kelvin, that light would have been familiar to us as the reddish warm glow of our incandescent light bulbs. But the universe did not stop there. Fortunately, it continued to expand over the next 13.8 billion years, and all of those 3,000 degree Kelvin photons redshifted all the way into the microwave spectrum of the cosmic microwave background that we know and love today. Now, that means that every ancient photon from the dawn of creation went from a very energetic frequency of 17.6 terahertz all the way down to a relatively more sluggish 160 gigahertz. We've mentioned more than a few times that the law of conservation of energy tells us that mass energy cannot be created nor destroyed, but only transformed from one form into another, or transformed from one place to another. So, tonight's puzzler is, where the heck did all those photon energy from the Big Bang go to? Any ideas?
I'm going to make a guess on this one, Roy. You have a finite amount of heat in the original fireball of the Big Bang. That ball had a certain surface area, 4 pi r squared. As the fireball grows bigger and bigger, that same amount of energy is now being spread over a larger and larger area on the surface of that ball. Therefore, the same amount of energy represents a lower and lower temperature as the ball gets larger. So it's sort of an inverse square law-like function. That's a guess. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
The problem, though, is that with the expansion of the volume, you also have a decrease in the field strength. So the case could be made that you could have the fall off. You know, when you're saying the, you know, 1 over r squared, when you're saying that photons fall off over a distance, they fall off in intensity. They don't fall off in frequency. We don't experience, for the most part, radio waves that redshift themselves as they get farther and farther from the transmitting antenna.
KG2FIU.
Yes, George.
I would think that the contraction of the energy is forming mass that contains magnetism, or magnetic energy that is drawing it to making a massive mass objects.
VDH would a comment? Yes, VDH.
I would think, I'm just taking a guess, that if you were to sum up or integrate over the entire volume of that, I think it's 3-degree background radiation, that is really staying the same. It's just that it's occupying a larger and larger volume as time goes on. Good.
Well, John, that's a good idea, and that's what one would think. But again, if you plug in the numbers, what you get is the field densities work out, but there's no real way to construct why the actual photons seem to have lost all of this energy. It's not that the same total amount of energy exists, because the field strength dissipated as the volume increased. That's where the energy equalized, but in addition to it equalizing for its increased volume, it seems to have lost additional energy in the actual frequency. You know, E equals H nu, Planck's constant times frequency. So as you decrease the frequency, you decrease the energy of each photon. Now, not only do you have less photon, the photons are more spread out, so you have less photons per unit volume. You also have lower energy photons that when a physicist do the math, it doesn't add up.
Any gas that expands goes to a lower temperature. And on a physical point of view of the molecules bouncing against each other, by the ping-pong paddle effect, I can explain that one, Roy. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Okay, but that's kinetic energy of particles. These are photonic waves of electromagnetism. That's where there's a problem.
I see what you're saying.
Interesting.
Yes, Wesley.
Energy could be changed to mass. Mass could be changed to energy. That's my answer.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul, in a second. Wesley pretty much said something very similar to what George said, that this was due to mass. But there is no particular measurement of mass being spontaneously created. As far as the Big Bang theory goes, for all intents and purposes, all the matter in the universe kind of came into existence some ridiculous short interval like 10 to the minus 40th of a second. And from then on, other things have been changing, but the total mass of the universe is not believed to be growing, because you would have to posit exactly how that was happening. And there's no good theory that suggests that. But, Paul, you wanted to say something.
I was going to go with what George said, but since he took that, maybe this stuff, all the photons have wound up in black holes collectively. You know, we can't find it. They've essentially disappeared from our universe.
Well, we should ask ourselves, were photons the first particles of the universe? And if so, the photons initially collide, form was electrons and positrons, so the collision was the one who made the energy to change to matter.
K2IS, comment.
K2FIU.
So one at a time. Wes, there's interplay, high energy photons. They have to be very high energy to be able to spontaneously decay into particle-antiparticle pairs. And then you're stuck with the antiparticle that doesn't really exist in the amounts that you would want them to, so that's a bit of a confusing thing. So that would be a problem for me and for physicists, I believe. Next is AC2IS.
And my answer is that the frequency has changed due to relativistic redshifting. AC2IS.
Okay, and you would sort of be right. That's what we call that when it does that. But that still imparts a question of that needs energy to go someplace else. If it was say on a light emitter that was now on a rocket engine that was being powered farther away from you, that would be the energy that was causing the relativistic redshift. But there's no rocket ship. There's nothing that we can count energy going someplace else that's equaling the amount of apparent energy that we're losing from the photons becoming lower and lower frequency.
Dr. Roy, initially there were no stars or galaxies, just hot dense sea of particles and radiations, which means photons. So the photons were the one who had to collide. So somewhere in 10 to minus 35 years, later, there was inflation that began. And this interval, some photons were created of different energy level at part of cosmic background. Entropy.
AC2IS, comment.
Bill and George, we'll get to you in a second. I just want to address Wesley. As I mentioned way back at the beginning, very early in the universe, according to the Big Bang Theory, there was mostly photons. For every particle of quarks and electrons, leptons, if you will, there were a billion photons. So in a way, yes, there were a lot more photons than there were the particles. And the cosmic background microwave energy is made up of enormous number of photons, even to this day, even diluted. It's an amazing amount of energy. It is most of the energy in this universe is that background radiation, but some of it has gone bye-bye, and I thought it would be interesting to kind of go around and figure out what's happening. Now, we'll get back to you, Wes, if that didn't help the question that you asked or the statement that you made. We'll go to Bill next.
Okay, so I'm going to take a wild guess that the energy that you're describing, so the relativistic redshift is happening due to the expansion of the universe. Right, so wherever these photons were emitted, now we're traveling away from them so quickly. That's where the relativistic redshifting is coming from. So I'm going to say that somehow this energy goes into the expansion of the universe itself. In some way this is driving the expansion of the universe, or there's some acceleration to the expansion of the universe that's due to this, driven by this energy drop. That's my best guess. AC2IS.
2H.
Okay, Bill, that's a very good guess, and it'll lead to my dropping of the second shoe, where we add another wrinkle to it that you might see as agreeing with your premise. But we'll get to that in a second. George, you wanted to say something.
I may explain it more simply. The way I view it is that you have expansion and contraction from the smallest to the largest of bodies, from the smallest of particles to the largest of bodies. It's going to expand and contract. Whether or not we think it's growing, is it growing? No, I don't think we know if it's growing because we're viewing it from the size of what we are here looking at. But it's energy, it's physics. Energy speeds up, it slows down. From the smallest of particles to the largest of bodies. Planets, stars, whatever, or particles around us. And I don't think we have the purview to understand precisely what the dimension of it is. We don't know that much right now. But in order for it to speed up, it's got to slow down.
I have a problem with that. MY2H.
Okay, we'll hold off, Wesley. Lou, what do you want to say?
So, when people talk about a vacuum, they say, vacuum really isn't empty. And I guess particles can appear and disappear through some quantum effects. So I'm just going to throw in the quantum activity as being responsible for this.
Hey, Lou, it's always good to throw in a quantum thing, and in a way that's going to be part of the answer. But Wesley, you wanted to expand on your disagreement or something?
In order to expand and to retract or shrink, come back, or whichever term you use, you need vector. When you expand, you need vector of expansion. When you and you need another vector that is opposite to that vector in order for the matter to go to vibration. There was, at the time of the Big Bang, there was nothing that would allow double force action, I believe. You understand my very much primitive language.
I must admit, I don't quite know what you mean by double force.
The vector and the opposite vector enter exchange. There was no opposite vector. There was only expansion.
Yes, I would agree. If there wasn't expansion, everything would be very, very small, and none of us would be doing any of this at all.
Yes, by that, I disagreed with the previous statement.
Okay, and you're more than happy to take disagreements between each other and even to myself, and we can discuss them and try and make sense out of them. But let me add this little permutation that some people suggested in different ways, and Lou suggested in a very nice way. There's something called vacuum energy, unfortunately. In Newtonian physics, in the ancient days, Plato said many stupid things. But, you know, he said many smart things, but every so often he said a stupid thing. He got the number of teeth that women have wrong, so it's kind of confusing to me how he could get that part wrong. But he also believed that perfect vacuums could not exist in nature, that they would require infinite amounts of energy to maintain. And it was a complete misunderstanding of concepts of vacuum. So people demonstrated near complete vacuums without that much of a problem. But the problem in the 20th century was quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics has the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which means that nothing can be zero. Everything has to be fluctuating. And that means that there are virtual particles of energy and matter popping in and out of existence that has a non-zero energy called the vacuum energy. Let me drop for a sec.
Okay, excellent.
One sec, Rich. I just want to finish this line. So in addition to the vacuum of space having an inherent non-zero energy level, everyone knows about the Hubble constant. It's a number that's been calculated and recalculated. This week we believe it to be approximately 71 kilometers per second per megaparsec. That means, in a different way of thinking of it, that for about every million years, the entire universe expands by 0.007%. That's 0.007%. The entire universe expands every million years. So the point is that with this expansion, it means that there's more empty space. With more empty space, there's more vacuum energy. So we have the same problem on the other end. Where the heck is this vacuum energy coming from? It just seems to be spontaneously popping into existence. This strikes me as just as bad as the fact that the cosmic microwave background tends to be losing energy.
It's a matter contribution. When you calculate energy momentum tensor of the matter, then you have conserved quantity that you usually find in the right-hand side of the ancient equation. So this leads to conserved total energy. There is a time-like vector present. In order to have a contraction, you need to have a force that is pushing it to contraction. We might imagine that when you move a number of particles, let's put it in not in photons or in particles, away, then you're creating a disbalance from the source and that group of particles. In between that, you have an empty space. Now, you can call it vacuum. But the question is, in what format you take in it to compare that this vacuum parameter is important in that what you're saying about. And to explain.
I'm sorry, Wes, you kind of lost me. As space expands, you have more space, which is more vacuum, which all vacuum has at minimum a vacuum energy, which is non-zero. So every time that the universe expands, it seems to create some form of energy, which kind of doesn't sound quite right if you believe in the conservation of mass energy. I'm not quite sure what your answer related to that.
Jackson.
Okay. If you consider the complete matter gravity action, it has a lot of invariances, in particular under the time and the space translations that leads to the standard procedure, the conserved currents which contain contribution to the pure gravity. So what I'm trying to say is that maybe the gravity factor is the one that should be considered, because the empty space by itself is only this balance when you compare two factors, the origin and the particular point in space that you're referring to. Entering shift.
KD2FIU.
Okay, first Rich, and then we'll go to you, George. So Rich first, WB2GXM.
AC2GS, WB2GXM. Is another word for the vacuum radiation Hawking rate, or am I relating that to something else?
So that's something completely different. Hawking's radiation is the black body radiation equivalent of a black hole in the event horizon. That as black holes get smaller, they actually have a higher black body radiation temperature. They radiate more. Small black holes will evaporate much quicker than large black holes. But that's completely different than the non-zero vacuum, the non-zero energy level of just, you know, a cubic parsec in outer space that has absolutely no particles. It's as close to a perfect vacuum as you can, but it has quantum fluctuations and an inherent non-zero vacuum energy.
Thank you.
Welcome, Rich. I think next is George. Yes, George, KD2FIU. You wanted to say something? Okay, maybe George will come back soon. So basically, I've given you kind of two confusing things. That according to the cosmic microwave background, energy is somehow just ceasing to exist as the universe scales up. And also, the vacuum energy, it would indicate that somewhere else, energy is actually going up. The vacuum energy of more volume is going up. So what would be a nice idea is to simply say, well, that's where all the energy is going. All the energy lost on the photons of the cosmic microwave background are simply being shifted into the vacuum energy. But the problem is that when they do the math, there isn't enough energy lost from the cosmic microwave background to equal all the vacuum energy that's created. So unfortunately, we can't use that even as a guesstimate. So there's something else going on that's causing all of this, and I'll ask if anyone... A lot of people have kind of touched on the borders of it and said the magic words in slightly a different order than I would tend to, but if anyone has any further ideas before I kind of tie it up in a bow, feel free.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
As far as the vacuum energy, though, those particles flick into existence and out of existence. In the average, over any period of time, don't they average out to zero since they're here and gone again, as it were?
Well, if you posited a universe in which there was positive and negative energy that fluctuated in and out of existence, then the average would be zero, and you would be correct. But we don't really know what the heck negative energy might be. I mean, we've kind of used it to keep wormholes theoretically open and all kinds of fun stuff. But in practical science, we have no clue if negative energy. So no, because although the positive energy fluctuates and the average is small, there's nothing that negates the fluctuations of the positive energy. You would need something, again, like negative energy to do that.
Interesting.
I just wanted to make sure that John kind of agreed or accepted my explanation of that.
Yeah, I understand. I follow your argument. Thanks.
D2IS comment.
Okay, we'll go to Bill, and then we'll go back to you, Wes. Bill first.
Okay, I'm going to expand slightly on my previous answer slash theory. So, yeah, we've got expansion of the universe going on. But I guess, you know, the fabric of space is expanding, so I don't know if you want to count things that are moving apart as part of the expansion of space to really be having momentum that carries them away from each other. But let's, if you say that you do, and yet there is acceleration of that, so let's see, if you have kinetic energy that's tearing things apart, so you've got kinetic energy and then the potential energy of them being drawn back together, but then there's again this additional acceleration component, and I'm guessing that this frequency difference somehow falls into that acceleration component of you know, increased potential energy due to just the distance of objects increasing over time. AC2IS.
Okay, but rather than solve the problem that suggests even a worse problem, you still, now you have momentum increasing, so you have energy increasing. I guess theoretically you can fudge and talk about gravitational potential energy, which a lot of physicists are going to, you'll hear, are going to use as the excuse for what's going to go on. But you still have the same sort of problem in that momentum is increasing, and that's another form of energy that doesn't seem to be conserved.
Yeah, my apologies. This is not an area of my expertise, so I am making some wild guesses. AC2IS.
Oh, they're very good guesses, Bill. And like I said, I'll wrap this up soon because I don't want to impose upon Paul's space report. But part of that is addressed by some physicists on some side of this argument. Now, Wesley, you wanted to say something?
Rather statement and explanation. The photons might lose energy. This energy is converted to vacuum energy.
Like I said before, Wesley, that would work out nicely if the math kind of suggested that the magnitude lost equals the magnitude gained. But unfortunately, when they do the math, and you could say that they're not doing the math right, there's a lot less loss and a lot more gained. So the books don't balance.
Yes, I'm waiting for your explanation. I was thinking about the dependence of the luminosity per distance. I was thinking about, you're going to laugh, Doppler effect, the loss of energy by photons and disappearance energy in empty space. I was thinking that Asian equations could not be integrated in this area. So many things. I'm waiting. Enter Asia.
Okay, I think I heard someone doubling. Anyone else want to say something before I tie it up in a bow?
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
So, the universe is expanding, and is this missing energy somehow involved in the rate of that expansion, or have an effect where it's being utilized in the expansion?
Traction.
Second, George, I do want to wrap this up soon. The expansion is acting upon the background cosmic wave background radiation, causing this apparent energy loss, rather than the other way around, which I think you were asking. if somehow the dissipation of energy is driving the expansion of the universe. I don't believe that physicists think that. They think that it's a normal nature of the universe in an inflationary condition, and it's an aspect of that inflation that causes this weirdness of the energy apparently being lost in the cosmic microwave background. George, you wanted to say something?
Thank you, Roy, and I apologize that there's things going on here. The way I understand it, from basic physical science, going into Newtonian basics that I've learned, is that in order for it to expand, you have to have a force of contraction. And it doesn't matter what size of particle level, what size of body, what size of sphere of all the bodies and the particles. It's not one space interacting with another space. It's all space, and it's all happening at once. You have energy, and you have a contraction of energy. And that's the exchange. I don't know, I really don't know what words to put to it, but I learned it basically, that's the way it is. All energy is expanding and contracting on every size and every level we could imagine.
Okay, George, that theory, I believe Wesley has a problem with that theory. I think Newtonian physics is nice for approximations, but unfortunately, when you get into the really weird questions, you unfortunately have to throw away Newtonian physics and rely on the relativity and quantum mechanics, as more than a few people mentioned tonight. So if anyone has any other comments, I'll give you a chance, and then we'll get to the end of this, Chase.
Interesting.
Yes, Wesley.
I think my opponent is trying to implement Friedman model to interpret full ancient tensor, the pure gravity energy, momentum tensor. Problem is that I'm talking about Newtonian. So it seems like when we have absence of the matter, the ancient tensor vanishes. It doesn't exist. So that's why I disagreed with my opponent. It seems that useless interpreting its energy momentum tensor for the gravitational wave or whatever the wave or whatever the force into exchange.
Okay. I think I'll kind of tie this up in a bow right now, because otherwise I don't want to get in the way of Paul's space report. The answer is probably not going to thrill too many people. The answer, unfortunately, is that the conservation of mass energy is not 100% legit. In normal environments of the Earth and lifetimes and, you know, 1,000 years, 10,000 years, 100,000 years, it's pretty much conserved. The problem is that the concept of conservation of items is related to something called translation, invariance, or symmetry. In other words, if you shoot a rocket today with a certain amount of force for escape velocity, it will be the same amount of force tomorrow. It will have been the same amount of force last Wednesday. The amount of force that you need to oppose constant gravitational force is constant. So it's time invariant. And on Earth, and for 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years and so, it's perfectly legitimate to say that. The problem is the universe. The universe is 13.8 billion years, and that's a long time, and unfortunately, time-space itself changes. And it's part of that expansion of the universe is altering time at wide ranges in the time interval of the life of the universe. So, unfortunately, many physicists believe that the conservation of energy law is a limited case law. It's not an absolute, and it completely collapses when you talk about the vacuum energy on one side increasing over the expansion and the cosmic microwave background decreasing in energy over the expansion. Now, some people who really don't like that will say that there's some potential gravitational opposing factor that balances out this equation and that, once again, energy is conserved. But a lot of physicists think that that's a counting trick. So it's either, as a few people mentioned, the potential gravitational energy, or it's the fact that relativity allows for conservation of energy to not really work at extreme. That's my little spiel. Anyone with any comments, closing comments, before we hand it over?
This is it.